Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard another great episode of the Sing Second Podcast. Spring has sprung around these parts, ladies and gentlemen. In Annapolis, it's been gorgeous. The flowers are blooming. The baseball team is traveling. The distinguished grads are caucusing. This Friday, March 22nd, is the distinguished graduate ceremony. And we'll talk a little bit about them here. And there's a bunch else going on the yard. The new Shipmate magazine is on its way to your mailboxes. It includes this month our annual travel guide, which we're very excited about, too. If you want to join Chris Cervello on, like, septuagenarians and octogenarians only trip of Glacier Bay in Alaska, that'll be available to you. But speaking of elderly people who like to talk a lot, Chris, I've got to cold open it here and ask you how your interview was, spoiler alert, ladies and gentlemen, Chris Cervello is on top of everything else, an incredibly accomplished podcast producer and works with a couple of other pods. And on the Defense and Aerospace Cavas Ships podcast, you guys talked to 82 grad Ward Carroll, previous guest on this pod. His wife, Carrie, works here as the director of membership. What did Ward Carroll have to say? I'm always interested in Ward Carroll's content.
So let me just start off by saying, so we had, like you said, we had Ward on. Ward talked about his progression from naval aviator to communicator to media tycoon to now YouTube host. Ward is good, John. I mean, it is, it warms my heart as a friend of Ward's and as a fellow Academy grad. He knows his shit about what's going on in the aviation community. Operationally, from a budget standpoint, which is really what we wanted to talk to him on the podcast about, he is a great guest, which shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that has listened to this podcast over the years, but he was fabulous. We loved having him on. It's just so good to talk to Ward. So thank you for bringing that up. And I hope people will check out that episode of the Cavas Ships podcast with our guest, Ward Carroll.
Yeah, and Ward is opining at a very unique time, and this is where I'll ask you, to also put on your, Navy expert hat. As all of these budget requests have come in, as the decommissioning list is growing, despite the overall plan to get to 381 ships. From your perspective, Chris, really staying in these circles, in and around the Pentagon in D.C. In addition to a very busy spring training schedule, which we will more importantly get to in a minute, what does this outlook look like for not only alumni and supporters of the Naval Academy, but people in and around the national defense space? These seem like very delicate budgetary times awaiting us.
Yeah, John, I mean, when we worked in the Pentagon, I think we thought we had delicate budget times. And I have never seen anything like this in the 20 or so years that I've been around the budget. I think delicate is the right way to put it. The Navy has said for several years that it wants to grow in the 40s to a number greater than 355. I think you mentioned it, one plan has it growing into the 380s, 390s, but it's got to shrink in order to grow, right? There's that phrase, divest to invest. Fellow Naval Academy alum and current Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, and his team. I mean, they're making really tough choices. They're making tough choices to try to get us from legacy stuff to new and improved stuff, whether that's ships, airplanes, submarines, things for our people to use that will help us deal with the competitive environment that we've talked about many times. So yeah, there's a lot going on in the budget world, and they're not helped by the fact that the Congress is probably as political as we've ever seen them in turn, and are not taking up the budget in regular order. So we're 6 months into a continuing resolution.
Who knows if we'll have a shutdown at the end of the week? Who knows if we'll get a full year budget? All of that makes the current budget environment very difficult, to say nothing about what they're having to deal with 5 and 10 and 15 years out.
Yeah, and remember, ladies and gentlemen, that these budgets don't necessarily impact the U.S. Naval Academy. When there's a government shutdown or sequestration or something like that, yeah, the operations of the Naval Academy stop, but it's another reminder for everyone that the real power behind the Naval Academy, you know, the building of Hopper Hall, the support of international programs, and things of that nature happens via philanthropy. So really, the Naval Academy is doubly squeezed here in this budgetary environment. Number one, not really knowing what it can count on from the Pentagon, but right, then also needing the generosity of our alumni to really get the Naval Academy pistons moving. Four people who have been distinct in their philanthropy and support of their alma mater will be honored on Friday. Chris, the distinguished graduate ceremony, which takes place every March, will take place on Friday night. The Alumni Association and Foundation will honor four extraordinary alumni at the 26th Annual Distinguished Graduate Award Ceremony in Alumni Hall. What started back in the late 1990s with Admiral Moore as the very first distinguished grad, comes, back into Alumni Hall on Friday night, whether it's helping shape the future of the armed forces and their warfighting capabilities, supporting veterans, or providing opportunities to current and future midshipmen. These four alumni are dedicated to uplifting others, and we love telling those stories on this podcast. We will have a great interview right after I'm done with this very long introduction. We'll have an interview with one of our distinguished graduate awardees in Jerry Miller from the great class of 1977. We'll talk to Jerry about, his beginnings, where he came from, and why he gives back to the Naval Academy, not only in the shipbuilding space, which affects and helps the Navy writ large, but also through the Levy Center, the Jewish Chapel on the Yard. Jerry Miller played a very large role in fundraising for that, which has provided a great service to midshipmen for nearly 20 years now, over 20 years. So Jerry Miller will be joining us. Also being honored on Friday will be Admiral Sam Locklear from the great class of 77 as well, Admiral Dennis Blair, class of 68, and Mr. John Young from the class of 1978 as well. We will be putting out a release this week and we'll be posting all over social media on Friday. Chris, before we go to break and listen to our interview with Jerry Miller, your thoughts? You and I have come across all four of these gentlemen in various means, but, in particular, I remember distinctly, Sam Locklear. The first time I met him was as Lieutenant Schofield teaching here in Luce Hall, and he was the commandant. But you and I have had a lot of time around these gentlemen.
Yeah, we have, John. And four really fantastic examples of what it means to be a Naval Academy graduate, whether that's through being a four-star, or whether it's leading in industry, or whether it's leading in government, or whether it's a combination of all of the above. These folks, as do all of our distinguished graduates, they represent the Naval Academy with distinction day in and day out. So pretty cool for them, pretty cool for the broader Naval Academy community.
Yep. And check out our website for information about how to nominate someone if you believe that someone is worthy of being nominated as a distinguished grad. You can get information on that process as well. So without any further ado, let's get to our interview with Jerry Miller. After we talk to Jerry Miller, ladies and gentlemen, after a quick break, we've got another great interview highlighting what is happening on the Naval Academy yard. And we just came out of spring break. And while a lot of people were Chris Cervelloing it in Cancun, getting after it with, people blowing whistles and doing tequila shots, the Midshipman Action Group was out in the Pac Northwest doing community relations activities. We're going to talk to Midshipman First Class Max Bueno. He was the president of MAG. He is now the Naval Academy Brigade PAO, and in a great position to talk about the amazing things that MAG midshipmen are doing, further educating you about the amazing things, whether it's, taking 22 credits or doing mandatory sports period. Mids are very, very busy, but on top of that, they give back, and Max Bueno will talk about that. But first things first, here is our distinguished graduate, one of four from the class of 2024, Jerry Miller. We are really honored to be joined by one of the distinguished graduate selectees, Jerry Miller. Jerry Miller is from the class of 1977. And you know how I prefer surface warfare officers around here, ladies and gentlemen. So I'm happy to give that little nugget of his bio before we introduce him more fully. First of all, Jerry, thank you so much for joining the podcast, and congratulations on being selected as a distinguished graduate. Before we get into, your origins and your foundations that brought you to the Naval Academy, just kind of off the top of your head, what's the feeling of being selected as a distinguished grad going in with, three other great men in this ceremony at the end of the week?
Well, thank you. It's a very humbling feeling. There's a lot of guys in our class and a lot of people that graduated before and after me. So to be selected is a great honor. And like I said, I feel really good about it.
So you're from upstate New York. You graduated from high school in 1973. While your father had, World War II ties, you didn't really have a lot of Navy foundation in your family. So kind of walk us through how Jerry Miller goes from high school in upstate New York to graduating from the Naval Academy in 1977.
Yeah, well, thanks. When I was in the eighth grade, it so happens that I had a teacher who had just returned from Vietnam as an Army officer, and he knew my father because he was one of those guys that, came up to the buy and used auto parts and hung out at the junkyard a little bit. And he suggested to me that, I should consider going to a service academy just because, and his attitude, it was kind of funny because his idea, because I was involved in selling used auto parts. So it was kind of a place where you're always making a deal and this and that. So he was talking about it from the standpoint of, I remember exactly what he said was, yeah, you should go to one of these service academies. You go for 2 years and then you quit. You get 2 years of free school. And I'm like, okay. And that was his first idea. And then, he put the idea in my head. I always, from my father and all my uncles and everybody in that generation, most of them had served in World War II. So not that you heard a lot of stories about it, but you heard that, they were in the service and they talked about their time in the service, not the details of what they did, but just that their time in the service, who they met, where they were. And so as a young kid, I always felt like I wanted to serve. And then when that suggestion got made to me in the eighth grade, that kind of put the idea in my head about the service academies because I hadn't really considered it. And I think my recollection is that was shortly thereafter, I watched an Army-Navy game on TV and, just got excited about it. And then from then on, I just decided that's where I wanted to go to school. And I did a lot of things in high school that I thought would enhance my chances to get in there. I was the president of my student government, stuff like that in high school. So it just felt like, I like doing that kind of thing. I like being, in a leadership role, and it just seemed like it would be good for my resume to get into the Naval Academy. And so that's what I did, and I was pretty focused on that.
So once you got there, and I know that everyone, no matter what class they're from, had the last real plebe year. A lot of people lose track of what the culture was and what the environment was like back in the mid-70s when you were, walking up and down Stribling. A completely different world, a completely different environment coming out of Vietnam, a completely different viewpoint of what being in the service was all about. Certainly at a time of dwindling faith in our public institutions in the wake of Richard Nixon. So walk us through what the environment was like back in the 70s, because today the environment is, hey, we have cellular service and air conditioning. It was a bit different back then, but not just from the amenities standpoint. I think, it fascinates me to know what the culture was like there in the mid 70s.
Well, I just remember graduating from high school and I had to report to the Naval Academy 2 weeks later. So I got myself a haircut, and, when you had hair that short, I mean, nobody did back then. And it was like, wow, what's your problem? And being in the military was not something that, people were excited about. So on the one hand, it probably enabled people like myself to get into the Naval Academy. And, you know, it wasn't quite as competitive as it is right now. So that was a good thing, but it was, it was a little different. And when we finished our plebe year, for example, Richard Nixon actually spoke at the class of 74's graduation. And I remember thinking this is the only place, one of the few places in the country where he could do this. And then he resigned shortly thereafter. But the things have changed a lot, much for the better. And you got to also keep in mind in 1977, or, you know, when I got there in 73, it was an all boys school and there was no thought of women coming in there. And then my senior year is when the first women came in the freshman class. And in those couple, 3 years, a lot of things changed. And there was a lot of people that didn't ever think that could be possible, that we would have women at the Academy. And of course they've done fantastic since they've been there, but it was a big change. There's been a lot of changes, much for the better when we got there. I also mentioned that in 1973, so just before we got there, the Supreme Court made some kind of a decision that chapel could not be mandatory. And that became a big part of my history with the Naval Academy is the chapel. And, you know, we got involved in the Jewish chapel and all that. So that was pretty interesting back then.
I'd like to pull the thread a little bit on everything you've done for the Levy Center. As I was the PAO there when that was really, coming up and being established, you know, so much through your philanthropy. But you bring up a good point that upon your graduation, you go out into the toughest of the tough, in my opinion, and all surface warfare officers think that they have the baddest beats in the Navy, of course, ladies and gentlemen. But, you know, you go out there and you're doing the toughest jobs. You're on an oiler. You're the repair officer. You're a damage control assistant. You eventually survive and teach ROTC at Old Dominion University. But, you know, you just mentioned it from being there and being a firstie when the first women arrive at the U.S. Naval Academy after a long awaited integration. And now just viewing the first ever female superintendent taking the reins in the last couple of months in the form of another surface warfare officer in Yvette Davids. How do you look at this, you know, as an alumnus, you know, looking back at the evolution of your alma mater?
I'm very proud of the fact that the Naval Academy has evolved to this point. When you look back at it, thinking that, you know, times were different, so it's hard to compare. But when you think that it was an all-male school and they didn't allow women, and considering the performance that females have had in the Navy, you know, in the officer corps as well as enlisted, you kind of shake your head the fact that they didn't allow that for so many, for such a long time. So I'm really, really proud of the fact that, you know, the Naval Academy is out front on a lot of these issues.
So what was it about the Naval Academy time? Now, obviously, you've gone on and we're going to cover, you know, the success you've had in the civilian world. But what were some of the lasting lessons that you learned, you know, in your 4 years along the banks of the Severn there? You know, was there a particular leadership lesson? Was there, you know, a moment on the athletic fields? You know, everyone has kind of one of those galvanizing moments that either validates why they're there or it pushes them into the success that they get after graduation from the Naval Academy. Do you remember any seminal moments in your time on the yard that kind of pushed you to where you are today?
Well, it certainly wasn't on the athletic field. That wasn't not my specialty. I didn't have that much success doing that kind of thing. But, you know, just a whole... There were so many things that happened. I think just, you know, the time in Bancroft Hall, the time you spent just with the other guys, getting to know people from all over the country and realizing that, you know, there was so much in common between us, yet there were cultural differences between people. I think that was probably one of the things most important things that I got out of the Naval Academy was just to be interacting with people from everywhere, all different walks of life, and working together with them and being able to, you know, form the bonds that we did. And then also, you know, just the things that you had to do in forming, you know, different groups and teams to accomplish whatever it is that we were working on at the time. I think that was really important. As I say, I came from a small town and you did certain things, but when you get in a group like that and everybody has to work together and you find ways, you meet wonderful people that I'm still you know, very close to. I think that's probably what the biggest thing I got out of it.
So growing and managing teams, as you say, you know, really became, you know, the framework for your success out of uniform. Sure. If you can, you know, and your distinguished graduate selection is based on almost completely on what you've done after being in uniformed service. If you can kind of encapsulate, you know, what you did, you know, what was the driving force for you to get out of the Navy and pursue your exploits in the civilian community? And if you can just kind of capture some of those exploits, because it's an incredibly impressive resume. I don't mean to embarrass you, but, you know,
no, thank you. Appreciate
we want
that.
The audience to understand exactly, you know, who Jerry Miller is. And you've definitely taken the tools at the Naval Academy and made them work for you.
Yeah, well, I certainly, you know, I enjoyed my time at the Naval Academy. I enjoyed my time. I shouldn't say I enjoyed it that much at the Academy. It was some tough days, but I enjoyed my time on active duty, but I just didn't feel like it was something that that I wanted to do for my whole career. And having grown up, you know, selling used auto parts and being involved in the, you know, auto industry. And then I found myself in the shipyard for 15 months on an old destroyer, and I was the repair officer. So as equipment was removed off the ship and being overhauled, I was responsible to follow up on all that. And I realized that the people that worked in the shipyard were very much like the people that I knew from the used auto parts business. So, I mean, it was the kind of, you know, handy people that, you know, knew how to do things, you know, physically that I was not that capable of doing. I was always, even as a kid, I didn't take the cars apart as much as I would just buy and sell the, you know, parts and vehicles. So I realized that, and it was those people that could get the work done, you know, the things that you had to be able to count on them. And I realized that when I started my business, it was a number of events that occurred, but one of my classmates had gotten out of the Navy before I did. And he ran a shipyard. He was the production manager at a shipyard, and he was told a year into the job that he needed to lay off all the employees because they were selling the property. In Newport News, Virginia, they were selling the property to the city, and it was a third generation business. So he was getting out. He came to me all excited that we needed to start a shipyard because he knew where all the good people were. And I said, you know, we didn't have any money at the time. And I said, I don't know how we're going to do that. I was still on active duty, but, you know, one thing led to another. When I got out of the Navy, we were able to get something going, and we were able to start bringing some people on, and we get little different projects to do on a ship. And I knew it had to be done, but we had to find the right people to do it. And I learned to, you know, to put your faith in people that had the capabilities and show them that you trusted them. And people want to do the right thing, and they want to make the boss happy. They want to do what they're assigned to do. And if you let them do that, and you give them the, you know, enough, give them the right tools and the time to do it, it can all happen. And so I learned to trust people and who to trust, and started to build a team. And then the success I think I had over the years was, you know, knowing who you could trust. And that was, had a lot to do with, you know, Naval Academy colleagues and, you know, people that had the same similar types of background that I had as far as, you know, military training. So learned that, and also realized that it was the ship repair business was the kind of thing that really hadn't changed a lot in decades, and it was ready for some changes. And when we started the business, it was kind of the end of the Cold War. So the Navy, you know, Ronald Reagan was building 600 ships, and we got close to having 600 ships. And then as the Cold War seemed to be winding down, you realize that the Navy said, oh my gosh, we got 600 ships. How do we take care of all these? So they had to have some different methods and different processes. And we helped develop those, I think. So I was real proud of that.
Well, you look now, and I'm getting a little bit of uniformed PTSD as well, you know, particularly since I, you know, one of my public affairs officer jobs was with research development and acquisition, several tours at CHINFO, and we heard quite a lot here in the last few years about maintenance and modernization in shipyards being a real driving force to our success or our failure, you know, and you've got all of these ships with maintenance problems. You've got all these overhauls that are required. You've got, you know, stories left and right, particularly building the new frigate up in Marinette, Wisconsin. That frigate, just like the LCS programs before it, is a little bit behind schedule, and first of class ships are always, you know, behind and over cost. But how do you now evaluate, with your wealth of knowledge and experience, How do you evaluate where we are, you know, in terms of shipyards being able to maintain and modernize this current fleet as, you know, there is a specter of a naval battle in the 7th Fleet AOR lurking out there? You know, how do you look at it with all of your experience?
Well, we have a lot of challenges right now, and I'm probably when I sold my business in 2012 and thought I was going to get out of the shipyard business, and it wasn't. It was shortly thereafter I wound up back in it, and my company now is more focused on new construction of ships, and we work a lot with Newport News Shipyard and Electric Boat and the aircraft carrier and submarine construction. So we're doing a lot of working mostly with that. There was probably you know, in the late 80s early and through the 90s that the shipyards really atrophied, and they weren't hiring like they were hiring in the 70s and 80s. So you had a whole generation that where in the past, if you go back even before my time in the business, I think it was a very it was somewhat expected that if your grandfather worked in the shipyard, your dad worked in the shipyard, and you would, you know, that's how the shipyard got a lot of their tradespeople. And then what happened is in the 80, you know, late 80s, in the 90s, they just weren't hiring that next generation, and it kind of went away. And then you have all the different technologies that have come up, you know, in the last 30 years have gotten young people away from wanting to, you know, be welders, pipe fitters, electricians. So we don't have as many people that are striving to do that in their careers. And so that's something that we're trying to change right now. And there's a lot of efforts going on in our local community in Hampton Roads and throughout the country to get people involved and interested in shipbuilding and some of the trades that that we're short of right now. And we're doing a pretty good job of recruiting new people, but it's going to take time. And one of the things we find at the shipyards is that and you hear these reports that one of the big shipyards will hire, you know, 2,000 people in a year, but they lose 2,000 or 3,000 people. And those folks aren't staying for a long time. So they take a job and realize after a few months or less than a year that this isn't for everybody working in a shipyard. I mean, it's not easy work. It's very rewarding, and you can accomplish a lot, and you can see the fruits of your labor, you know, every day, but it's hard work, and it's good, you know, very good paying jobs that we have right now, but it's hard to attract people that want to put in those kind of efforts. So we're working on that. And the government, the Navy itself is spending a lot of money trying to do that. They're trying to build the industrial base back to where it needs to be. And so we've been the recipient of quite a bit of industrial base funding, you know, so we, you know, our company continues to grow in that.
Well, that funding is very much needed. You took, you know, a very small amount of funding, as you said. In 1985, you co-founded Earl Industries, you know, with your Naval Academy classmate. You purchased a shipyard in 2002 after taking sole ownership of Earl in 1989. You grew the company to 1,200 employees, and then General Dynamics, you know, as you mentioned, eventually purchased that shipyard. And it's not like you didn't do anything, you know, with the profits of that venture. It's not like you then kind of took your foot off the gas pedal. You stayed involved with your alma mater. You've taken the money that you've made and given back to the Naval Academy in great measure. But yeah, Most notably, and you talked about it before, you're one of the principal leaders of the Friends of the Jewish Chapel, raising $13 million. To build the Levy Center. You know, what inspired you to start giving back? It wasn't just the availability of money, I imagine. You know, that there was something else that was the foundational element behind your motivation to make sure that you left your alma mater better than you found it.
Yeah, thank you for that. I was fortunate to have some success early on, and we had some good customers. We started the company with no money, and that was a pretty fortunate thing. We had a couple of good customers that paid us immediately, and we didn't have to wait on getting our funds. So that was good. So we never had to take any outside money from anybody, which enabled me to kind of make my own decisions and probably take some chances that other people might not have taken. And particularly if you had other investors and you had to explain all your actions to them. But on occasion, there were opportunities that we went after that worked pretty good. And then what happened was I made a little bit of money, and then I got involved in some other businesses and got involved in some real estate development in Virginia Beach, and that has that enabled me to do a number of other things. So it wasn't, the ship repair business was good, but it wasn't what really it enabled me to do a lot of different things. And so that was good. And so I was having a lot of success, and I felt very good about it. It was at a young age, and I was kind of inspired at that point that, you know, if I was going to be this fortunate to make some money and have it, I wanted to do something that was that would be meaningful. And this show happens that the Levy Center was an idea that some people had, this Friends of the Jewish Chapel. And I got a call in 1998. I was doing pretty well. And I guess these guys had heard about me, and they asked me to come to a meeting, and the Levy Center was already kind of in the planning stages. And then they told me they needed to raise money, and they had a process to raise money, but they hadn't made all that much progress, but I love the idea. And it was something that, you know, when I was at the Academy, there's not that many Jewish people at the Academy, and there's not, and I didn't, I had a few Jewish classmates that I didn't know them that well, but I didn't have anybody that was real close to me that was Jewish, but I found myself talking about it a lot just because I was different than other people in that respect. So, you know, there was a lot of discussion, and it felt right when this thing was presented to me, it felt right. It was that a lot of work had already been done when I was there. There was already a memorandum of understanding with the federal government to get the property on the Academy. And I thought this was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up. Talked to my wife about it, and she was very supportive. You know, went to a meeting, and then I just got myself very involved in it. And it is a great feeling to be involved in it. And I thought it was like the opportunity of a lifetime, and that, you know, if I didn't do it, somebody had to do it, and somebody had to really step in and do it. I had the ability to do it. And I thought, you know, if I didn't, then it might not get done. And it was something that I couldn't let happen. I would have regretted it if I didn't. And then the more we got involved in it, the more rewarding it's been. It's been fantastic. And as a result of that, before they built the Levy Center, this group, the Friends of the Jewish Chapel, had arranged to have some trips during spring break for random midshipmen that could apply for this 10-day trip. And they would go to Israel or someplace in Europe and talked about, you know, what had happened, why Israel was formed. There was a couple of years where they couldn't go to Israel. They wound up going to Eastern Europe and doing some exploring. It would always take about no more than 30 midshipmen, because we wanted to keep it to one bus load. And then my wife and I went on a couple of those spring break trips. And what we realized was that, well, a lot of things, but the midshipmen were a whole lot smarter than back when I was a midshipman. That was one thing we realized. And that there was men and, you know, male and female. So I noticed a difference kind of in the way, you know, just in behavior and just the general way midshipmen, you know, acted 30 years later, whatever it was. And I also realized the impact that a trip like that would have on kids, and how they would, you know, could see the world a little bit differently once they were over on the ground and saw how, you know, particularly in the Middle East, in Israel, where you have so many different people of different faiths, and there's so much controversy and turmoil, and there's so much beauty and history there. So the kids, they learn so much, and they're so interested in it, and it's very impactful. And so we realized that this is really important. And what we were doing, you know, not only made us feel good, but it would have a huge impact on the Naval Academy and the Navy itself. You know, to have a Jewish chapel in the midst of the Naval Academy, it wasn't because we had a lot of Jewish kids. It was because we wanted to show that, you know, this is a Navy and a country that is rich with many different faiths and opinions and attitudes. And we, in order for us to be the United States, we have to all work together. So I think that was kind of the symbolism of it. And every time I walk by, I'm thrilled that we did that.
It's so funny. Very similar words to what you just used were just spoken by Charlie Bolden when he came on the pod a couple of weeks ago. We were talking to him about African American History Month, and he sounded exactly like you there for a second, sir. You know,
Charlie's a great man. If I can compare to him, I'm a happy guy.
The foundation, you know, is on diversity. And when I was the public affairs officer there, Admiral Carter, the superintendent, was very proud to announce and flex the fact that we claimed and had a midshipman in the brigade from every single congressional district in the country. That makes it, you know, I know that we've got a long way to go with diversity, but it makes it a melting pot, and a melting pot that's worth all of these philanthropic dollars. And I want to pull the thread a little bit more on that before I let you go, but over 400 midshipmen have benefited from, you know, your sponsorship of these spring break trips to Israel. You know, friend of the pod, Chris Hoffman, when he was a commander and teaching in Hopper Hall, went on one of those trips. Hopper Hall was also one of the recipients of your philanthropic dollars to include the Terwilliger Center and the Brigade Sports Complex. And this is where I really want to foot stomp the idea that we continue to go across the country in our engagement efforts as an alumni association and foundation to remind people that, you know, that it is not in the presbud, it is not in the it is not in the Defense Authorization Act and budgeted in all of these things that keep the Naval Academy going. The Naval Academy gets certain dollars from the Pentagon, but so much of the Naval Academy is powered by philanthropy. You know, the building of Hopper Hall, the sponsoring of international programs, spring break trips. You know, being someone who has made giving back really a part of your portfolio since you were able to, you know, how much do you want to help foot stomp that idea that your dollars are making a difference for the current brigade?
Well, there's no doubt about it. And I'm really proud of that. And I feel great about it. And the other thing that we've done, these spring break trips, they were good. They are good. And it's a great experience for midshipmen, but even better, my wife and I have, for the last 7 years, we've sponsored 15 midshipmen each summer to go to Israel for it's a 6-week program. They do, the first 2 weeks are at the academy, and they study Arabic, the first semester of Arabic, so they can have a little bit of language when they go over there. And they do that for about eight hours a day for 2 weeks. Then they get on a plane and go to Haifa University and spend 4 weeks there studying with people from all over the world. Haifa University is one of the most diverse colleges in the world. And they study and hang around with kids from all over. And then during those 4 weeks, they also have a tour guide that takes them all over Israel, and they learn a lot. And we really enjoy seeing those kids before they leave and after they come home and talking to them about the impact. And particularly when you see what's happened in the Middle East in the last few months, that's the kind of thing that happens. And I realize how important it is that what we do. This really hit me, you know, 20 years ago when we were building the Levy Center and the coal got bombed. And I remember that day watching TV and thinking to myself, because if there was ever any doubt, you know, spending a lot of money to get this chapel built, we were doing a lot of work. And I said, if there's ever any doubt in my mind that we're doing the right thing, it's gone. Because when you think about it, when I thought about it on the coal in the year 2000, you know, 20 plus years after I'd got out of the academy, and I was thinking, you know, it could be one of my classmates or somebody that I knew that's a commanding officer of the coal. I don't remember who it was, but, and I was thinking, you know, I hope they understand, you know, what is going on in the world. Not that I understand, but I mean, I hope they have an understanding of some of the history and some of the cultural differences that we have. You know, when we had a Cold War going on, when I was at the academy, it was just, we had to man up the ships and the submarines, and we're chasing the Russians. There was a lot of things going on, but it was still, you were kind of working in your own world. And nowadays, the way we've been engaged on a military side is, you know, it seems like you have to, you know, be aware of all these cultural differences and try to understand other people, because people don't think the way we think, and they don't, you know, when you get to that part of the world, I mean, it just seems like there's a whole different mindset of how we value different, you know, human life and everything else. So,
yeah, it's an interesting narrative now where midshipmen, as they graduate, particularly this class of 2024, you know, they almost need to be much more ambassador like, you know, than
I agree.
Even, you know, the mid 90s when I was commissioned, the mid 70s when you were commissioned. It's a continued evolution and a very volatile AOR, multiple AORs out there, China and the Taiwan Strait, Israel and the unrest there, Ukraine and Russia, you know, and most notably, you know, in the Red Sea with Houthi missiles, inbound to DDGs almost every day. Before I let you go, in these interactions, now you've been a member of the foundation board since 2006. You have been a leader in that regard for so long, and we appreciate that. But, you know, I still think that the value that, you know, the John Ryans, the Jerry Millers, the John Youngs, the Sam Locklears, you know, the Bob Natters, that, you know, that value is still in what wisdom that you're imparting upon the current brigade, these members of the brigade who are going to go out and be those ambassadors that we were just talking about. What's the thing that you come back to when you're talking to midshipmen, either on these Israel trips or in your interface when you come back to the yard so often? What's the lesson that you really want to impart upon them?
Well, I just think that that there's a lot of different thought processes in the world, and people think a lot differently than we think. And we're pretty happy in our island nation of the United States right here. And we're not affected by a lot of the history that that these cultures have, and that they don't forget, and that they continue to fight about. And so it's important that we realize that these people, they just don't have the same values that we have and the same thought process that we have. And things that are important to us are not necessarily that important to them, and vice versa. So I think we have to be respectful and mindful that that's the way the world is. And I think, so we raise a lot of money, with the foundation and to maintain this margin of excellence. And I don't think there's anything more important than having these midshipmen have experiences before they graduate somewhere outside the United States. One of the goals that Admiral Carter had these things change over time with budgets and all that, but one of the goals was to have, 500 or 1,000 midshipmen a year, or some number, go overseas and spend, 2 weeks plus on some kind of a trip. We didn't have any of that when I was at the Academy, and I don't think anybody really thought that it was that important at the time. But I think now, when these kids going out into Marine Corps officers, Navy officers that are going out there at 22 years old, they have to have some experience or some ideas about what the rest of the world is like. And, I joined the Navy because I wanted to serve and I wanted to see the world. And the Navy sent me to Norfolk, and I've never left the Norfolk area. But, and that's, I've traveled some myself, but times are different now. And I think it's important that the world is so small, that social media and all that, and kids hear stuff and they watch the news on TV a little bit, maybe. It's just, you got to be on the ground and really see it for yourself and understand what the world is like. Because just to watch one of the network shows for a half an hour a day is not going to tell you what the world, how it's like in the rest of the world.
Yeah. And it will often leave you a little bit jaded to watch that. You got to go out and be, life is a contact sport. You got to be participatory. And that's what the Naval Academy, I think, prepares these young women and men to do. Really quick, before we go out, what's next for you? You are not someone who sits idly by. You like to be busy.
Yeah.
So what's the next project on the horizon?
From my business side, I have a lot of different businesses that I'm involved in right now, particularly, a lot of them, and almost all of them, have some kind of Naval Academy connection, whether it's some people involved in it or something that we're doing, for the Navy or with the Navy. I've got some pretty exciting companies that I'm involved in, and just keep doing that. I would be very disappointed if I wasn't still involved in the shipyard business. And I thought I was getting out of it 10, 12 years ago, but I'm happy to be involved in it because there's so much going on right now, and there's a big need for some innovation and continue to modernize.
No, I completely agree. And Jerry, as I let you go, there's one quote that I'd really like everyone to hear that I think really encapsulates you. And you said, "Financial success came early for me, and I was both advised and inspired to appreciate that success by giving back to help others. And, yeah. you know, to help others is the real, you know, exclamation point on that sentence that, you know, philanthropy is meant to help others. Your philanthropy has helped your alma mater and countless sailors out there, midshipmen, as they prepare to be these leaders of character and consequence in the fleet today and in the fleet tomorrow. So from me to you, thank you so much for being a part of the foundation, being an alumnus who is active and always giving back. And thank you for helping others. I'll give you the last word, you know, after I say congratulations on your selection as a distinguished graduate.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very humbled and to be mentioned with people like you said before, Bob Natter, Charlie Bolden, and John Ryan, those kind of guys, to be in those, to be mentioned in that same group is very humbling, and I do appreciate it.
Well, he is a member of the 2024 Distinguished Graduate Class, a class that will be celebrated on March 22nd at the U.S. Naval Academy. Jerry Miller from the great class of 1977. We're going to go to break. This is the Sing Second Podcast.
The Sing Second Podcast is sponsored by Scott Shooter and the Shrek Realtor and Crew team. Scott Shooter is truly committed to making your real estate transaction an enjoyable, stress-free process. His work ethic, honesty, and pride in his job were instilled at an early age and were reinforced through his education at the U.S. Naval Academy and his service in the military in the E2D platform. Those traits provide him with the tools to provide you with the professional expert service that you desire and deserve. Those traits are the foundation of his service to you and your agent. It is not just lip service, it is a way of life. You can start your home search by visiting Scott Shooter's listings and property search page. Please visit scottshooter.com. That's scottshooter.com. Scott Shooter, the Shrek Realtor and Crew, a proud sponsor of the Sing Second Podcast.
All right. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we are back on the Sing Second Podcast. Really special interview this week. I'll tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, we usually do alumni, but in our continued effort to educate alumni about what's going on the yard and the great programs that midshipmen are doing, you know, practicing, you know, those highest ideals of command, citizenship, and government. In my opinion, it gets no better than the Midshipman Action Group, ladies and gentlemen. And if you were a graduate from like mid-90s and earlier, you might have no idea what the Midshipman Action Group is. And so to help educate you about that, we're so happy to have the former president of MAG, which I think was a three-striper position, Midshipman First Class Max Bueno. And now he's really put his head on straight. This particular semester before he graduates, he has the most important position in Bancroft Hall. He is the Brigade Public Affairs Officer. Max, first and foremost, thanks for being, our interview this week. And why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to the alumni? Where'd you grow up? What made you want to go to the Naval Academy? And let's just go from there.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me today. My name is Max Bueno. I'm from Middlebury, Connecticut, a small town out by Hartford. And I wanted to come to the Naval Academy because of my great grandfather. He served in World War II, and he didn't have the opportunity to become an officer. So for me, the Naval Academy has been the opportunity to live on his legacy. Now at the Academy, I found a special place in my heart for volunteering. I found that after the pandemic, a lot of the programs that we had were having a hard time getting off the ground again with a lot of the, you know, a lot of the remnants of the pandemic really affecting the local community. So I found my place with MAG, with the Midshipman Action Group, helping out in the Annapolis community and especially in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. So, I got to lead MAG in the fall this year for ACT Year 24. I was the president with some new things starting up again. We had the Annapolis Boys and Girls Club start up in the spring last year, and I was the public affairs officer back then for the Midshipman Action Group. And I saw it all the way through till now. And right now we're looking forward to doing our spring break trip, and we're volunteering out in Washington State at Everett, right outside the Naval Base, at Whidbey Island, right outside the Naval Base as well. And also in Bellingham, Washington, we'll be helping out with a Native American tribe. So all really great stuff, and all the things I look forward to with MAG are because of the impact we have on the community.
Well, I'll tell you what, Max, when I was the PAO there, you know, I didn't know anything about MAG. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was a thing. I just figured that midshipmen are usually taking about 20 to 22 credits. They have mandatory sports period. You know, the plebes are, you know, doing all the plebe system stuff. And when I was told that on average, there are more than 20,000 hours of community service a year coming out of the Brigade of Midshipmen, I could not believe that. And then when Miriam, and I have to give so much credit to Miriam Stanicich, who's been running the community relations aspect of the public affairs office at the Academy for so long, when she listed down the things that we do, Girls on the Run, Habitat for Humanity, everything that MAG gets involved in, it's hard to wrap your head around. So for you personally, how do you manage the time requirement, everything that comes with leading an ECA, you know, being a leader in the hall, and then giving so much of your time on top of all of those other requirements?
I do think a lot about the time constraints that we have as midshipmen. But the one thing that I found for the people that do volunteering work, especially with MAG, is that we have a higher calling even beyond the service to the nation. One thing that was important was the establishment of the mission, service to the nation begins with service to the local community. And we really believe with that, we believe in that at MAG, because from the ground up, from the plebes that come in from their high school or from an experience in college beforehand, a lot of them have this drive to help out more than just the nation, to figure out the nitty gritty of the communities that help make the Naval Service proud and help us do our job. So ultimately, it's a source of giving back. Now, with regard to having sports period and accumulating, like you said, over 20,000 hours of community service as a brigade, we find time in some of the most awesome ways. For instance, because midshipmen that are underclassmen can't go on liberty until 12 o'clock on Saturdays, we host almost weekly volunteer events in the morning on Saturdays, and they're particularly filled with underclassmen. Personally, I take Wednesdays to help out after school because typically we don't have intramurals. And as a soccer manager, I don't go on Wednesdays because I'm able to go after school to help out at the Boys and Girls Club in Annapolis. So we're able to find time before study period at 2000 to help out wherever we're needed. And sometimes we have events that go into study period, but those typically are not during the academic heavy weeks that we do that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, completely. Well, you know, for me, a lot of people also likely don't know how many mids actually participate in MAG. This isn't just a small enclave of people. We had hundreds and hundreds of mids participating in events and comrels all year long when I was the PAO. And what I found, and now as the brigade PAO, Max, you might have a, you know, particular opinion on this, but it was always easy whenever there was a bad news story about the brigade to talk up MAG, right? Like every time someone got in trouble after leaving Acme at 2 a.m. or there was, you know, an academic cheating scandal, not like those are ubiquitous, ladies and gentlemen, they are very rare one-offs. But whenever you had a bad news story about the brigade that, you know, the Capital Gazette or some other publication might cover, we could always go back to, and it wasn't like selling a used car, but you could always go back to MAG, and that so many members of the brigade are giving back to the community. It isn't about them getting over on the community. It's about them participating and helping the community, right?
Yes. So for context, there are over 1,100 midshipmen in MAG. So almost 25% of the entire brigade takes part in this volunteer service, which to me shows how great of a community we do have towards helping more than just serving as in the military, which is awesome.
And so for you, I know that so many people who were with MAG or have participated in MAG, eventually as they graduate, continue that legacy of service, continue to give back wherever they're stationed, whether they go down to primary and they're participating in stuff in support of the base at Pensacola or wherever they get stationed. For you, what did you service select and how do you plan to continue to give back as you continue your Naval and Marine Corps career, you know, after graduation day?
So I selected Naval Intelligence. I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to do that. But for me personally, volunteering will definitely continue in the next few years, especially. And the reason I say that is because I recently was chosen to for a Rotary International Global Grant to study at Oxford. So over the next 2 years, I'll be able to expand my reach in the Oxford area, looking at intelligence policy and how we could help with the UK alliance and look at our Indo-Pacific partners, which is ultimately my goal. So especially if I'm volunteering or stationed in the Indo-Pacific, I'll find ways to help out the local community, just like I know my classmates in the triad that I had with me will help out no matter where they are, whether it's a basic school, whether it's down in San Diego or across international lines, we'll be helping out no matter where we are.
I know you will. And that is Mag in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen. Last question from me, Max. I know a lot of alumni who listen to this might be BGOs or have an influence on future midshipmen or high school students that might be interested in coming to the Naval Academy. And as we just talked about for 10 minutes, it's more than just marching and holding reef point 6 inches in front of your face. It's more than the rigors of a STEM-based curriculum and graduating with a Bachelor of Science. It truly is about the highest ideals of command, citizenship, and government. So having survived now 3.5 years, what advice would you give to high schoolers or potential students who are wondering if they're going to be the next Max Bueno? Should they consider, the U.S. Naval Academy as their college of choice?
I think absolutely. The kids that are coming into the Naval Academy nowadays that are looking at it had to deal with the reality of, COVID and growing up in high school with that. And I think in order to get the most out of their college experience, they want to look for the idea of command, the idea of government, of citizenship. And ultimately, the Naval Academy is the one of the only few places in the entire nation at all in one. So for the kids that want to be the next Max Bueno or the next volunteer guru or the next person that wants to just help out the people around them, I say that this is the best place to make that dream a possibility.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's called the Midshipman Action Group, MAG for short. And quite personally here, it is one of the best things about the Naval Academy and the thing that I took away as my favorite part of my tour as the Naval Academy Public Affairs Officer. That was Max Bueno, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go to break. When we come back, Chris Cervello and I are going to take it out. This is Sing Second.
Sing Second podcast is sponsored by ProMD Health. ProMD Health is a state-of-the-art medical practice comprised of several locations, all specializing in non-surgical treatments and procedures to help patients look younger on the outside and feel younger on the inside. At ProMD Health, their unique personal approach to medicine, coupled with their cutting-edge anti-aging treatments, provide their patients with unsurpassed care in a relaxing setting. They cater to patients that require the best in personalized medical care. Please visit ProMDHealth.com, visit their office in Annapolis. Friend of the pod, Scott Melamed, has been the original sponsor of Sing Second, and we encourage you to visit the website for your non-surgical medical needs.
All right, baby, we're back. Long episode, long interview with Jerry Miller, but he's a distinguished graduate. I thought it was worthwhile. Chris, before we go out, first things first, you've been traveling Florida. It's been spring break for you. You were able to catch a couple of Orioles games. As I speak to you, we are 1 week and 1 day away from what you and I believe is the best day of the year. It's the one day that I, muster the gumption to have a Natty Bow beer. It's my one a year. But all joking aside, you and I will be sharing time together, which is one of my favorite things, a week and a day from now for Orioles opening day. But you've been traveling around. You saw him play the Blue Jays yesterday. How excited should we be about the future AL East champs?
It's a very good team, John. A very good team. There's a lot of talent on that team. I think they're the hardest thing for the leadership of the Orioles is going to be figuring out who makes that roster and how quickly you bring other folks up. What a great trip. If you haven't had a chance to get down, obviously I'm biased. I wanted to see the Orioles, but that whole Grapefruit League set up there in Western Florida is just fantastic. We were in Sarasota. We went up to Dunedin, as you mentioned, to see the Orioles play the Jays. There were all sorts of fans all over. Everybody's friendly in the local area, too, visiting baseball fans. It was really cool. Really enjoyed it, and I can't wait for opening day.
Nor can I, and we're going to get warmed up after a little distinguished graduate action on Friday. Saturday, Army comes a-calling for Navy baseball, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen. This is not the star game. The star games will happen late April. In fact, it's the last star matches of the year when Navy baseball travels up to Army to play them there. But, yeah, on Saturday, we've got a big lacrosse alumni event for men's lacrosse. We've got baseball playing. A lot going on as we come out of spring break. So if you're coming back into town for the distinguished graduate ceremony, welcome. It should be fun. As we go out, I would be remiss, you know, and I'm not being cheeky or juvenile here, but there was really only one sporting event to comment on this week. And we talked about Ward Carroll. The origins of our friendship with Ward Carroll go back years, but really galvanized when Ward joined us as the third, the third host, so to speak, of the original Sing Second Sports podcast with myself and Bill Wagner, with you, of course, Chris Cervello pulling the strings and doing Old Man Radio as the producer. But really, really fun talking about Ward earlier in this podcast. I was able to see Wags last night at Navy Marine Corps Stadium, where the Villanova Wildcats came in and played lacrosse against the Fighting Joe Amplos. And the result was good for us Villanova grads, Chris. 14-7, an absolute stomping, which was interesting because I know, you know, friend of the pod, Jen Baker up at Hopkins, the Hopkins athletic director and class of 98 member. Hello, Jen Baker. I know that she took that loss pretty hard last week when Navy went up there and won for the second straight time at Homewood. But then they turn around and have a tough one against Villanova. This lacrosse team, as we go out, Chris, is going to give us a lot to look at. It's going to be an emotional roller coaster. And again, the stars are the most important thing. I know they have Army circled, but man, you just never know what you're going to get with this squad.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the sort of the fun rivalry between Villanova and Navy aside, I was surprised they didn't play better after that big Hopkins win. In fact, I thought that they might beat Villanova and put together a little bit of momentum, you know, heading into, I guess you'd say now, the second half of the season. This is what worries me about the lacrosse team lately. I mean, big wins, big moments, and then, you know, they seem to drop or I don't know that it's unexpected that they lost, but I thought they would play better, you know, so that there tends to be a drop off after these energetic performances. So I don't know what to make of lacrosse. I specifically don't know what to make of Army Navy lacrosse as we begin to approach it. It's nail biting time, John.
Nail biting time indeed. And remember, stay tuned here on Sing Second for everything going on at the Alumni Association and Foundation. And we'll even sprinkle in some sports. But for this week, I really want to end by congratulating John Young, Jerry Miller, Admiral Locklear, and Admiral Blair for their place as distinguished graduates in the class of 2024 of distinguished graduates at the Naval Academy Alumni Association and Foundation. That is it for us. Many thanks to Jerry Miller for joining us and Midshipman Max Bueno. Thank you to MAG for what they continue to do in this local area and around the country in their community relations efforts. And thank you to Chris Cervello for being the producer. Until next week, ladies and gentlemen, when Chris Cervello and I are at Oriole Park at Camden Yards, I am John Schofield. This is Sing Second. We are out.